I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston. When you think of a prison library, you may remember this scene from The Shawshank Redemption. It's where the prison librarian, played by Tim Robbins, helps his fellow inmates sort through books.
Soap carving.
Trade skills and hobbies. Goes under educational. Stack behind you.
Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas.
Dumas. You know what that's about? You like it. It's about a prison break.
We'll be able to file that on the educational, too, oughtn't we?
The prison library is where Malcolm X famously educated himself, and where the notorious Southie crime boss Whitey Bulger allegedly learned brutal military tactics. Well, Avi Steinberg grew up in Massachusetts and later became a prison librarian at the Suffolk County House of Correction. And he's written a new memoir called Running the Books. In it, he ruminates on the power within that room of books. Steinberg says the prison library was a place where he had to maintain a sense of authority and control, even though he describes himself as an asthmatic Jewish kid from Cambridge. Early in his book, he remembers a female colleague training him on the art of intimidation.
The first few seconds of every prison library period were crucial, she told me. That's when you establish your authority. She showed me how to stand, back straight, chest puffed out, arms crossed. Don't smile, she said. This isn't the Gap.
The library at the Suffolk House of Correction in Dorchester, over near South Bay, was definitely no trip to the mall. But Avi Steinberg says it was the place to be.
The library in a prison, unlike libraries necessarily in the outside world, and certainly public libraries, unfortunately, is a really, really popping place. I mean, it really is like this. It's like a bar on a Friday night. It's very, very crowded, very exciting.
You write in your book, it's where you go to see and be seen. Among the stacks, you'll meet older colleagues who gather regularly to debate, to try out new material, to declaim, reminisce, network, and match wits. You'll meet old-timers working on their memoirs, upstarts writing the next great pimp screenplay.
That's right. You know, in that first chapter, which is where that's from, I was really trying to convey just the range of things that brought people to the library. And even after working there almost 2 years, I was still finding new motivations for people to come to the library. Practically, it had a big law section, and that's actually legally mandated that we provided law books. So that's in some ways the core of the identity of the libraries. I think a lot of people came, including people who didn't even know how to read or weren't big readers, just to be in that setting, just to be in a library, just to be in a place that has carpeting. In a prison, that's a big deal to have carpeting. Everything is steel and concrete, so that to be in like a more civilized environment, it was just that alone brought people.
When you started working at the Suffolk County House of Correction, also called South Bay, I think at the time you were first living in Cambridge,
yeah.
You later moved to Jamaica Plain.
Mm-hmm.
So your little world's in Cambridge and JP, but every day you would go to work and meet people from all different worlds.
Absolutely.
And you learned that some types of inmates make better librarians than others.
Right. Pimps make the best librarians. That's according to them, by the way. But what I was getting at there and what I try to develop a little bit throughout the book is that a library becomes a sort of territory. And in prison, and also for a lot of these guys outside of prison, loyalty, territorialism is very important, who you're a part of, what group you're a part of. But the library itself becomes one of these territories. So people who start to identify the library with themselves and it becomes part of their prison identity. Those, I think, make the best librarians, people who decided this is who they are in the prison. They're the librarian.
Besides working as a librarian at South Bay, you ended up teaching creative writing first to the female inmates. Was it
right.
Tricky to get them to sign up?
No, it wasn't tricky to get them to sign up. It was tricky to get them to show up and to continue to show up and to excite them, which, of course, is the challenge of any teacher anywhere. Especially once I started to build a class as a poetry class, I saw more people show up because everyone wants to be a prison poet, you know. But really the challenge came later once the class is going, and prison can actually be a surprisingly distracting place. So I had to try to compete with what the other things that were going on were, and so that was probably a good type of competition.
You spend some time in your book talking about what you call the kites that you find in the library. These are the little messages that are tucked inside books, intentionally left there so mm-hmm. that one inmate can leave a message for the next inmate. Why do you call them kites?
That's what inmates called them. It's a metaphor for a letter, but it's like a kite, the kind you fly in the air. People would say, I fly you another kite next week, you know, and so I liked it as a metaphor. But basically, there's this strange feature of this library that the men and women inmates who never came into contact with each other, there's actually laws about how they're not allowed to come face to face, but they shared this space of the prison library. So it became just a convenient point to leave these notes inside the books. And so the books became mailboxes.
Would you read one of those kites to us?
Sure. Okay, Mario to Tea Baby. I did see you in the window last night, Sunday, July 23rd, again, getting your flirt on. Why? Daddy ain't enough for you? You act as though I'm secondhand smoke. Please check my pedigree. For the last time, I'm a thoroughbred.
So this is a lover's quarrel.
This is a lover's quarrel, yeah, absolutely. Is this in some way, this note is very typical. A lot of lovers quarrels, because once again, you had the men and women, some of whom knew each other from before prison. What he's referring to in this note is this other type of communication that happens in prison through the windows. And often that was to set up the spot. They communicate where to then fetch the note. So these communications were all connected. I should point out that it was part of my job description was to actually hunt down these letters and get rid of them. I was supposed to get rid of these
letters. To
find and remove these letters. So I was actually constantly searching for them, constantly finding them. I'm sure a lot of them slipped by me.
Would you remove them, or did you ever feel like I have to leave this one behind?
Okay, so then, and then there were a couple who, once again, that I actually did leave there that I felt almost obligated to. There was one from a brother to a sister, and their mother had just died, and he was basically breaking the news to her. It wasn't clear to me whether she knew, but he was saying to her that he supports her and she should know that he's always there for her, that kind of thing. I mean, what am I going to do, remove that letter? I can't. Can't do it. And I felt terrible removing these letters because you're messing with people's mail, and that's, last I checked, a felony. But, you know, once again, this is prison, you got to be tough. If I let all the letters go, then people get the message, oh, you can just do whatever you want in the library. So I need to assert my toughness also and show that this is my territory, you know. So,
when you first started your job, some people told you, take it easy, you can just glide your way to retirement. But this job actually took a physical toll on you.
It did, yeah. I mean, there are people who've been working in this prison for 30 years, and I like to tip my hat to those people because that's incredible. I was there for not even 2 years, and I was like broken down, honestly. It was just a physically taxing place for me.
Why?
I mean, just being literally in that environment, the lighting is awful. There's no windows where I was working. But it's also the little moments of stress you don't realize are sort of collecting. As I recount in the book, about 2 years in, my back completely gave out. And this happened actually while I was in the library, which is a very unfortunate moment.
Not because you had been doing physical labor, but just because the strain,
the psychological strain. I wish I could say blame it on that, but I was lifting a not particularly heavy box of books, and it all happened at once. There had been a collecting strain for me.
So, Avi Steinberg, you were feeling the physical and psychological toll of this job, but at least you got to go home at the end of every day. But one day, when you were walking home, something terrible happened.
That's right. I had gone to see a movie specifically to try to escape the tension of what I'd been experiencing for the last few weeks at that time. And I took the tea to my house at that point in Jamaica Plain, and I got off the tea feeling really good. I think it was a Friday night. I was just walking home, and all of a sudden someone comes up behind me and threatens me with what he said was a gun. Actually, it was not a gun. It was a knife. I don't know why he lied about it. A knife would have been sufficiently scary, and it was. And, you know, I had money, thank God, on me. And as I was giving him the money, he stops and his voice changes a little bit and he says, "Hey, do you work at the Bay?" And I was frozen, you know, because it's horrifying. Also, once again, funny because I was like, oh my God, how do you answer that question at that moment? This is like one of those things in the prison where I was like, nothing prepares you for something like that, really. What are you supposed to say? So I probably should have said something else. I said, "Yeah, I work in the library." He's like, "Oh yeah, the book guy, I remember you." And so once again, what's going to happen now? Is he going to take revenge on me? This is his moment to let out all the anger that he had while he was in prison. And I thought, well, on the other hand, maybe he'd let me off the hook. I helped him out. I don't know, something.
Could you now read what did happen? You wondered how this would play out, and you wrote about this.
Okay. If this were an inspirational prison movie, this would be the point at which he would have given the money back to me, cried, and thanked me for believing in him, just as Lean on Me cues in on the soundtrack. I, also in tears, would grab him just as he was about to leave and tell him he didn't have to do this anymore. There would be more tears. He would turn his life around. I would have learned an important lesson about the power of books to transform lives, about the inherent goodness of people, or whatever. The last scene would show me in a stupid tweed jacket, a few more wrinkles in my face and a sprinkle of white in my hair, as I take my seat at a UN ceremony honoring my reformed mugger for a lifetime achievement in humanitarian causes. But that's not what happened. A long second passed. I got the distinct feeling he was smiling behind his mask. He signaled to someone in the distance, turned away and jogged briskly into the park with my $43, earned at the prison that had, until recently, held him. Perhaps this was justice, I'm not one to say. He, however, did have something to say. "Hey," he yelled from about 20 feet away, "I still owe you guys $2. And then he disappeared, laughing into the night.
Now, you ended up telling other inmates at South Bay about this experience, yes. And you regretted doing that.
I did. Yeah, that was not the kind of thing you should say. I actually didn't mention this in the book, but the reason for that basically is, you know, this guy can come back into the prison, and he can come back into the library. These guys talk to each other. You don't want to bring this into the job. Something that happened on the street that you think is a remote moment in your life from your job all of a sudden becomes like an actual daily problem if this guy shows up in prison. So,
and it made you look vulnerable.
Yes.
In a place where being strong, or at least looking strong, is very important.
Absolutely. I mean, these guys, I told it to the staff of inmates who worked with me or for me. I was their boss. You know, we had some level of candor with each other. So I did tell them this. And they just fell off their chairs laughing. They thought this was hilarious. But also, yeah, they made fun of me because it's like, come on, you just let this guy rob you? And they were very angry at him, because he violated the code. And the code is, someone helps you in prison, he was good to you, he respected you, and you're going to take his money. They were furious about that, which is, once again, part of the reason why I should not have mentioned this. There's no casual story in there, because now it's like I'm part of this, I'm dropping in a piece of gossip that can become part of the war in there.
As we've mentioned, you weren't exactly the type of person that someone would expect would land at a place like South Bay for work.
Yeah.
You write that despite your fancy degree, as you call it, it wasn't a given that they would necessarily hire you. Can you read the part where you talk about that?
Okay. "While I don't have a degree in library science," I reasoned in a cover letter, "I possess both the skills and motivation to be a successful prison librarian." This was resume talk. The truth? I had never stepped foot in a prison nor worked as a librarian. Until I'd come across a listing, I hadn't even known such a job existed. I was interviewed by 3 people. The director of the prison's education department, which sounded ominous to me, the union boss, and the head of personnel. The blunt questions came from the union boss, Charlie. Pronounce the boss in a way, Charlie. "Where'd you grow up?" he asked. "A bit in Cleveland," I said, "but mostly in Boston." "Oh yeah, where?" "Cambridge," I said. His eyes narrowed. "Cambridge," he said, "is not Boston." Coming from a man raised in the Irish projects of Dorchester, a proud union man, this comment had a particular resonance. He was calling me out as a child of Cambridge privilege, who either didn't know the difference between an Ivy League enclave and the big working-class city, or worse, was posing as a city kid. "Yeah," I said, "but we have excellent views of Boston from our condos." Charlie seemed to like this answer. "You know," he said, "we don't like newspaper reporters, especially those know-it-alls at the Globe. Why should we let you in?"
But they did let you in.
They did, yeah.
Why do you think they did?
The truth is, I was really excited about the teaching aspect of this job. It's something that I talk a lot about in the book. I love teaching. It was really what motivated me from the beginning. I love being around books. I had been away from college like long enough that I'd actually started to realize how special it is to be around books, you know, on a daily basis. And I think they got that enthusiasm. I think they got the sense that, like, this is a guy who actually is really excited about doing this job, and that's not necessarily a given.
What's your advice to the incoming prison librarian, the replacement to you?
Small gestures make a big difference. People often ask me, did you feel threatened in there? Was it ever dangerous? You don't feel threatened if you just give a little bit. Giving a little bit, it really goes a long way. And I think overall you do need to take a hard line. You have to figure out this balance between being a hardliner, which you have to be in that environment. You just have to be a hardliner. But at the same time, see giving a little bit as a form of strength. And I think that actually goes a long way. And people respect it. They respond immediately to it. So,
Avi Steinberg, thanks for coming on Radio Boston.
Oh, thanks for having me.
To read an excerpt from Avi Steinberg's memoir, Running the Books, visit our website, wbur.org/Boston. When we come back, what Jane Goodall is to apes, Lisa Birnbach is to preps. And according to Birnbach, Massachusetts is a huge habitat.
It is so preppy. John Kerry, Governor Patrick, the Kennedy family. We smell the perfume of the Kennedys wherever we go in the state.
Stay with us. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.